From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jazz great Dave Brubeck was born in 1920, the same year as jazz great Charlie Parker. But Brubeck went his own way, West Coast, not bebop, but glorious, gigantically popular. He taught the world to Take Five, the tune behind us right here. He died this week, one day short of his 92nd birthday. This hour on Point, we are remembering jazz great Dave Brubeck. You can join the conversation. Is the Brubeck groove etched into your brain, on your turntable, your playlist? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a few minutes, we'll talk with Dave Brubeck's longtime manager, producer, conductor, Russell Gloyd, and his late-life saxophonist, Bobby Militello. But joining us first from Dallas, Texas, is Ted Gioia, famed jazz critic and music historian, author of The Jazz Standards, The History of Jazz, and West Coast Jazz. He's a jazz pianist and composer himself and was one of the founders of Stanford University's Jazz Studies program. Knew Dave Brubeck for a long, long time. Ted Gioia, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
We have lost a great, great, great musician this week. Take us back to when you first met Dave Brubeck.
I was in my 20s, and I was writing a book on the history of West Coast jazz. And I just wrote a letter to Dave out of the blue saying I would like to interview him for this project. And he very graciously gave of his time and his support. And then after that, he kept in close contact in later years. And what I experienced there was not at all unusual. You know, over the years, I've met many people that knew Dave long before he was famous, you know, people that were college classmates of his or knew him from other settings. And they all said what a loyal and dedicated and kind friend he was that would, keep those connections up over the years.
A great, great long life and ride, an unbelievable musical offering to the world around so long that I have to admit, until I read everything about Dave this week, I didn't know his background. I didn't know that he'd grown up on a California ranch with the musician mother and the roping champ father, and did literally spend a lot of time himself just on horseback and in that California ranch setting.
Well, you know, I was talking to a reporter the other day who wanted me to describe Brubeck's background, and I said he grew up in Northern California, and he said, could you be more specific? And I said, well, it's hard to be more specific because it was a 45,000-acre ranch that covered parts of three different counties, so I can only speak generally about the location. But, you know, Dave was a cowboy. He was a cowboy long before he was a jazz musician, and even when he went to college, his first idea of a career was to be a veterinarian. And only gradually discovered that his vocation was making music.
His mother pushed that with him. He had trouble with his vision all his life, cross eye and so on, that made it hard, maybe impossible for him to read music. It was all by memory.
Well, you know, he really trusted his musical instincts. He had poor reading ability at music, you know, and this caused real problems for him when he went to the College of the Pacific. You know, he was a music major, and they didn't want to give him a degree. And, you know, this is ironic because he's the most famous musician ever to come out of
the Pacific. He couldn't fill the formal requirements because of the vision problem.
That's right. You know, before he graduated, the dean called him in and said, you know, we are going to give you this degree, but on one condition, you must promise never ever to try to teach music at any point in your life.
And then he went on
and
to teach,
you know,
the world.
He agreed to that, and true to his word, he took a performing career rather than a teaching career. But, you know, what an amazing turnaround for someone that the college had such suspicions about.
Went into the Army as an infantryman in World War II, drafted there, ended up in the kind of a semi-official Wolfpack band attached to General George Patton's Army. They played a lot of popular standards, but also some original jazz tunes. Were there at Battle of the Bulge. He talked for years about the violence and killing he had seen there, how it affected him back in the U.S. And playing and just making amazing music. This is a 1952 Over the Rainbow, Dave Brubeck and Paul Desmond. Thank you. Dave Brubeck, Paul Desmond, 1952, and a beloved live performance there at the legendary nightclub in our backyard right here, Storyville, in Boston, Ted.
Well, that's right. Some of your older listeners may remember that club in Kenmore Square. I understand a Pizzeria Uno is on the site now, so you won't hear great music there, but you can at least get a pizza.
In 1952, when that crowd sat and listened to Dave and Paul that night, what were they hearing that these two, and Brubeck in particular, were bringing to the jazz scene?
Well, if you listen to this recording of Over the Rainbow, I believe it's a very historically important recording because during the course of this entire song, Dave does not use a single jazz rhythm. You know, jazz is built on syncopation, which is placing the accent between the beats, and that's mm-hmm. what gives the rhythmic excitement to jazz. And Dave showed that he could create a great jazz improvisation with no syncopation, playing everything on the beat. You would think this was impossible. This is like mm-hmm. trying to cook without spices or whatever. Now, interestingly enough, if you fast forward 20 years later to people like Keith Jarrett and these other musicians, they all began doing in the 1970s and 1980s what Dave had done at the beginning of the 1950s, which are to take these classical music rhythms and show that they could work in jazz.
How did the jazz world receive that? Did they say, oh no, this isn't jazz? What are you doing, Brubeck?
Well, Brubeck always puzzled people, and I think that was intentional. Years ago, I talked to Dave Van Creet, who had known Dave in college, and he said, you know, Ted, Dave told me early on that the secret to success in jazz was to come up with things that the other musicians couldn't figure out. You know, he deliberately wanted to push into areas that were beyond what other folks were doing. And so Dave often puzzled people, but he did it in a way that was so musical and so beautiful, he could do music that was both avant-garde and new and also appealing to a large audience.
Very appealing. First million-selling album, Time Out, 1959. Here was a TV interview with Dave Brubeck shortly after that came out, where Brubeck talked about what he was trying to achieve in his music.
The idea was the jazz used to challenge the public and make them think in terms more advanced rhythmically than they were used to thinking in. Mm-hmm. In the 20s, it was hard to get a group of people to clap on
yeah.
two and four. One, two, three, four. This was difficult. But we haven't gone much further. The public is ready for something new because everybody that listens to jazz can clap on two and four. But this period, 30 years is long enough to be stuck there.
Long enough to be stuck there, says Dave Brubeck in 1959. Let's listen to a little bit of the sound from before. And this is not Brubeck. This is Lou Waters and the Yerba Buena Jazz Band with Irish Black Bottom. This is 1941, but you'll hear the pre-Brubeck sound here, certainly. Not Dave Brubeck, but Lou Waters and the Yerba Buena Jazz Band, 1941. And Ted Gioia, there's your syncopation. There's the sound, certainly before.
Well, that's right. When Dave was coming up in San Francisco, Lou Waters was the most famous San Francisco jazz musician. There was a movement, sort of this Dixieland revival movement that was embracing traditional jazz. And when people in the jazz world thought of San Francisco, they thought of that kind of sound and of the jazz traditional revival movement there. And then Dave showed up, and he's playing such modernistic music, and he single-handedly changed the perception of San Francisco from being a jazz town for traditional jazz and turned it into a center for the most modern currents in jazz.
Let's go right to the sound then that he took us to. This is another one of his greatest. It's Blue Rondo a la Turk, 1959, Time Out. Dave Brubeck Quartet, 1959, Blue Rondo a la Turk, and we're in new territory here, Ted.
Well, you know, I've heard that recording so many times, but you know, it's still a delight to hear that. You know, and Dave would explain his influences, a bit of Mozart, something he heard in Turkey when he was doing work for the State Department. But still, the beauty of it is Dave comes up with these songs, and they do not sound like anything anyone's heard of before.
Yeah.
And Dave did that again and again in his career. He had this ability to tap into his own inner spirit and hear things in a way other people didn't hear them, and then bring them live on the concert stage or in the recording studio.
Dave Brubeck died this week. The day before his 92nd birthday, he performed very late into a long and rich life, a true jazz giant. Ted Joy is with us from Dallas today. When we return, we're going to hear from Russell Gloyd, Dave Brubeck's longtime producer, conductor, manager, and Bobby Militello, jazz saxophonist who played alto sax and flute with the Dave Brubeck Quartet. You can join the conversation this hour. Was Dave Brubeck your guy, your go-to jazz man? Did the Dave Brubeck Quartet live on your turntable? Did he make it to your playlist, your earbuds? What's the heart of his sound? Here he is with Louis Armstrong. It's 1961. Everybody's Coming, a jazz musical developed with his wife Lola, the Real Ambassadors, a collaboration around the civil rights movement. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. This is Tom Ashbrook and On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life and irresistible music of jazz great Dave Brubeck, who died this week at nearly 92. Ted Joya is with us. We'll hear more in just a moment. Behind us right now, it's a Raggy Waltz live, the Dave Brubeck Quartet. This is 1963 at Carnegie Hall, regarded by many as one of the all-time great live jazz performances. You can join us this hour. What's the heart of the Brubeck sound, the Brubeck spirit? Was he, what, too cool, too popular, too West Coast for you? Not enough bebop, or just right, perfect? And musicians, what's your take on the great Dave Brubeck? We're at 423-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. It's a Raggy Waltz right there. Ted, people still talk about that performance, and it's 1963.
Well, you know, there are many great jazz moments at Carnegie Hall, but that was just the right time for the right band. Dave was at the peak of his fame. And, you know, I give him enormous credit for having a career in which he was very successful, but he never once tried to do a crossover hit. He never, you know, I could sit down and I talked to him about this, looking at all the recordings he'd made over the years. Was there one he had done for some commercial reason or to make record sales? And no, he always pursued his artistic vision. And even at the peak of his fame, he's going back into the tradition with Louis Armstrong and playing St. Louis Blues and continuing with the experimentation in Carnegie Hall. Just a class act, both musically and offstage.
It's a Raggy Waltz. Let's hear from our listeners. Spokane, Washington, Beverly's calling. Hi, Beverly, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. It's Tom here.
Hi. Thank you for calling. What do you say to Dave Brubeck and his wonderful life and music?
Well, I want to tell you that I first heard it when I was about 11 or 12 years old. I was over at my neighbor's, who's quite a wealthy woman, and she went out and bought at least four copies, maybe six, and then she'd stack them on her LP, you know, side one. Side two, side one, side two.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was just playing constantly. And so I can't remember if she gave me the album or if I actually then, as a 12-year-old, went out and bought it for myself. I still have that original. And I have the CD version when it came out.
So did you listen to jazz before Dave Brubeck? Did he bring you in? Where did he fall in your...
He was definitely my first exposure, absolutely. No question. My family was more into classical symphony, music, ballet, that sort of stuff. So it was absolutely the first time I'd heard anything like that.
Beverly, it's wonderful to visualize the old turntable and the album stacked there, and you, very young, taking them on board. Thanks for your call from Spokane. Ted, please stand by. I want to bring in just a terrific pair of guests right here. Russell Gloyd joins us from New Haven, Connecticut, producer, conductor, and manager for Dave Brubeck since 1976. This is a long, long, and deep relationship. Russell Gloyd, I know this loss is still fresh. We acknowledge that, and thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure to be here, Tom.
And with us from Buffalo, New York, the great Bobby Militello is with us, jazz saxophonist, multi-instrumentalist, has been playing alto sax and flute with the Dave Brubeck Quartet since 1982. Bobby Militello, same condolences to you and our same deep thanks to you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, and we're grateful to you for being with us. Russell, what's in your heart on this just a couple of days after the loss of this great, great musician and man?
I think what has hit us the most is the worldwide reaction. I talked with every single news outlet from BBC to NHK in Japan to the French agency to NBC to CBS, straight across the board, the New York Times, and they all had the same reaction, which was, this hurts us too.
Yeah.
We mourn his loss. And you could feel it. You could feel it in their voices. I was on the phone with our colleagues in Vienna today, and I said, what's the feeling in Vienna? And they said, you can't describe it. You just know people have this on their hearts. And all of the success that we've had around the world. You know, this whole idea of West Coast, explain that to an audience in Vienna.
Right.
You know, explain that to an audience.
Yeah. What coast is that again? Where? What?
Right. Yeah. How about New York?
I would like to add one thing to the legacy of the College of the Pacific, which is there were actually two conditions. The first one, which you stated, was never to teach music. And the second one was promise never to return.
If they let him graduate, you mean, if they gave
right.
him a diploma?
Exactly.
Well, get out of here.
He did return a couple of times. One of them was to pick up his honorary doctorate.
Yes. Change of heart.
And then 10 years ago when they established the Brubeck Institute at the University of the Pacific.
Yeah. So, pretty big turnaround.
So that part of the deal has been broken.
Bobby Militello in Buffalo, you've been playing and playing with Dave Brubeck, and he played very late into this rich, long life. What are you thinking now at the end of this week, in the days of this loss, Bobby?
I lived half of my life with Dave. And when I first joined him, the intimidation factor, the fact that I'm playing with Dave Brubeck, was quite profound. And it took me a couple of years, tell you the truth, to get to the point where I could play to the max that I felt like I could do with him. And he opened that door for me. He kept on saying, take another one. That was a regular thing that he did to us when he thought you were burning and you were stopping for whatever reason. He'd take another one.
And by that, he meant solo on, Bobby?
That's exactly right. Don't stop yet. You got a lot to say. And after a while, then you figured it out and you start to get a synergetic relationship where you felt, and this isn't meant egotistically, where you felt at par when you were on the stage. You felt like he was the piano player, you were the sax player. And that was what was required in order to finally get us to rise to the level. I in my opinion, this quartet that we had was the best he ever had. Uh-huh. And this quartet interpreted his music in a way that used to put a smile on his face. He would walk off the stage some nights and look at us and go, wow!
And we're just talking like that. When he's in his 70s and 80s and 90s.
And just close to his 90s, yeah. There was nights where we would walk off the stage and look at him and say, where were you at tonight? What were you thinking about? I mean, he would play the intro to Theme for June or one of the ballads that he's written, which incidentally, that wasn't Over the Rainbow we were listening to.
Oh no, it was. Yeah, it was Over the Rainbow from Storyville. Summer Song, but see, it morphed into Summer Song. 10 years
I
later.
I wondered myself the morphing going on there.
Oh, okay, because that's Summer Song.
Now,
yeah.
And what was amazing about that is it was an afternoon, it was a Sunday afternoon concert. And if you really listen closely, you will find that there is no bass player because they couldn't sober him up.
So never mind.
And at the very end, they say eight with changes, and that's when they go into the melody of Over the Rainbow. But that melody, that improvised melody, Dave loved so much that it became Summer Song, which was sung by Louis Armstrong.
Amazing. Right.
Now, how that came about was there was a young college kid, Freddie Taylor, and he snuck a recording, a Wallensack recording, under his chair. And had so no one knew it was being taped. And at the end of the performance, he nervously said, "Mr. Brubeck, would you like to have a tape of tonight?"
Thank
and
heavens.
Who was in the audience? Yeah. And who was in the audience that afternoon was every jazz musician, because it's a Sunday afternoon; they're not working. And probably the most famous jazz musician that was there that day was Marion McPartland. And I asked her years ago when we were putting together the 4-CD box set. Time signatures. I said, "Marion, what song would you like to include?" And she didn't hesitate. She says, "Over the Rainbow, Storyville." I was there.
We've got a caller who may have been there too. John in Boston is calling. John, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was at Storyville about 55 years ago when I was a kid in high school, and I was at that concert with Dave Brubeck playing. But the add-on is that the great jazz trumpeter Chet Baker also played with him and separately, and it was
what
really
a show.
Wonderful.
Oh my gosh. Did you know then, all those years ago, how big Dave Brubeck was?
I was a kid that was a fan of jazz, and I knew he was a great sound, and never would have imagined that he would be what he was. And Chet Baker, too, again, was emerging. Of course, he had a tougher career, but I would have never quite guessed that he would reach this eminence that he did.
Incredible.
But it was a wonderful evening. Boston was a great jazz city then with the hi-hat and hear Louis Armstrong and all that.
Oh, yeah. Get all the jazz. And there
and this was this was the quartet's very first tour to the East Coast.
So we're
and
talking,
the next stop was Birdland.
Wow, we're talking hello America. John, thank you so much for bringing that memory back. Russell Gloyd, you wanted us to play Body and Soul. Of course, this goes way back, a 1930s jazz standard, but the Dave Brubeck Trio played this back in 1950. Let's listen, and you can tell us about it, Russell. Body and Soul, Dave Brubeck Trio. Early on, the Dave Brubeck Trio here. What is blossoming here, Russell?
Well, it's again Dave taking a standard and making it non-standard. When was the last time that you heard bongos?
In Body and Soul.
And the bongos are being played by Cal Jader, who later went on to a very, very great career as a Latin star.
It's just
the trio came about because in Mills College, where Dave attended after the war, Darius Milhaud, the great French composer, said to his class, "You must write all your exercises in jazz." Well, this is a pretty amazing statement, considering at that point, if you played jazz in any university, you were subject to getting thrown out.
Right.
But Milhaud insisted, and so from that class, they added some friends from the Bay Area, in particular, an alto sax player from San Francisco State named Paul Desmond, and formed the octet. It was such a success that they worked two jobs in 3 years. So that wasn't going to be a future, but the rhythm section of the octet became the Dave Brubeck Trio, which existed from 1949 to 1951, and ended when Dave suffered a horrible back injury diving into a wave in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
The water left, but the sand stayed. And as he was being carted off to the hospital, he heard them call in saying, we've got a DOA on our hands.
But it wasn't. And he went on.
And he went on, and that's when he formed the quartet in 1951 with Paul Desmond.
I want to flash it way forward to 1998 when Bobby Militello was right in the middle of this. This is Waltzing, 1998, cut from the Dave Brubeck Quartet off the album So What's New. And right off the bat, we get to hear that signature saxophone from Bobby Militello. Bobby Militello right there, 1998, from Waltzing off So What's New with Dave Brubeck. Bobby, what was it like to be playing up against right there with Dave Brubeck? Where did he drive you with his piano style?
It's interesting where he drove me because many people have actually noticed the difference in my playing now, and my playing was affected quite profoundly by Dave. Dave was an interactive guy. He was an ear player. Mm-hmm. I'm an ear player, and that means you know your changes, you know all of that kind of stuff, you know what's there and the math of it all, but you don't use that when you're playing. You stop thinking when you're playing. And Dave would listen to us as much as we would listen to him, and the effect was Dave was experimenting in this right about this period of time. He was starting to get into 12-tone stuff, and which is sort of Stravinsky-esque for someone that doesn't understand 12-tone. And he was starting to experiment with a lot of different styles, and those styles we were throwing back and forth. He would one night come out and start to play kind of out, and we would play more out, and he would jump on top of that, and maybe for a week we would be playing out. And there was a transition of my playing that happened as a result of that experimentation that he was going through. Some of the most beautiful tunes he wrote in his liturgical pieces and outside of those. Chorale was one of the tunes that he wrote that's a 12-tone ballad that was absolutely gorgeous. And there were so many others that he, and so many influences within his liturgical pieces that he did that were 12-tone that were some of the most challenging things for vocalists to sing. And then we would get to play on top of this stuff. The experiences that he gave me were extraordinary. My life changed completely as a result of that that synergy and that fun that we had together. And also, just one quick correction. I'm sorry I had to do that, but his wife's name is Iola.
Excuse me. Of course.
Yes.
Of course, Iola. Excuse me. The wonderful Iola. Year after year, decade after decade.
She's so... and I'll tell you what... if there's one thing I can say that would really be important, it would be that Iola was the driving force of his life. And she was so much a part of everything that he did. She was on the road with him, always there. And the two of them were joined at the hip. I mean, they were holding hands at 9 years old. They would walk around. I mean, they loved each other sincerely and honestly. And she really did affect things that Dave did. Sometimes she helped him with a set list.
Yeah.
Sometimes she would do things, but she was always there. She was in the dressing room. She'd be sitting in a chair on the side of the stage and watching us play. And we'd come off and
talk about a forever relationship.
I'm telling you right now.
Our heart is with her today, Iola. You know, Bobby, we've got to take a short break right here. Bobby, Russell, please stick with us. Ted Joy, it's so great to have you all. We'll go out right here with London Flat, London Sharp, 2005, Bobby Militello's saxophone. Out front, we're talking about the great Dave Brubeck. 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the life and irresistible music of jazz great Dave Brubeck, who died this week, just one day shy of his 92nd birthday. Behind us right there on the sunny side of the street, Dave Brubeck Quartet 2003 version of the jazz standard from Park Avenue South. Bobby Militello played with Dave Brubeck for years. Jazz saxophonist, multi-instrumentalist, joins us today from Buffalo, New York. And Russell Gloyd is here, producer, conductor, manager for Dave Brubeck since 1976. A long, long relationship and a great long ride of musical genius. Ted Joy is with us from Dallas, Texas, author of The Jazz Standards, The History of Jazz, West Coast Jazz. Also, Dave Brubeck for a long, long time, as did so many in America and around the world. You can join us this hour, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's hear from our listeners, Casey in Lincoln, Rhode Island. Casey, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Hi, Tom. How are you guys?
Very well. Hi.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call. Yeah, Dave Brubeck was a huge influence on my musical career, just like it started. I first read the sheet music of Blue Rondo a la Turk in my high school jazz band, and that changed my life and how I viewed rhythm, both, because that song goes from 4-4 to a 9-8 time signature with all these amazing influences of different cultures musically. So it's just, it's really sad to hear that he passed this week, but I'm sure he not only influenced me, but many other young musicians.
What a legacy. Casey, how old are you? What do you play?
I'm 24 now, and I play drums, mainly percussion, and I play now professionally, working on a couple musical projects, and he had a huge influence on my life. So.
You and a whole chorus of others. I'm very happy to hear from you, Casey. Thanks so much for your call. Let me get one more here. Oh yes, please, Bobby.
Russell. How many generations?
How many? Count them. I mean. Almost 92.
How many?
Yeah,
going through the 30 years with Dave or so, just watching the kids coming up, and then another generation of kids coming up, and then another generation coming up. One of the funniest things was when we got Russell. When was it? Was it last year that we got the Downbeat Jazz Award?
Well, last year and this year.
And this year, too. And he was 89 years old. Yeah, right. And we got the Downbeat Best Jazz of the Year. Best Jazz Group of the Year. And
amazing.
It was like so funny to walk into the room. Dave, how many times have you done this? How many times in your life have you been Best Jazz
Group? I mean, just this week, a posthumous Grammy Award nomination for Best Instrumental Composition category for the symphonic piece, inspired by Ansel Adams, Black
Ansel
and White
Adams.
Photographs.
Right.
Incredible.
Ansel Adams, America.
Yeah. Just incredible. Bo writes to us, listening to Dave Brubeck as a young teen changed the way I listened to music from then on. Scott says he was perfect. He was groundbreaking and experimental without getting lost in freeform jazz that had no cohesion. True pioneer, consummate musician, Charlie in Murrells Inlet, South Carolina. Charlie, you're on the air.
Tom, thanks ever so much for having this important show.
Yes.
It's really great. And a little plug for Marion McPartland. You mentioned her earlier. She's going to have Dave on her show live. It was taped, of course, around 8, I think, Saturday or 9 on the PBS stations. And that should be great to listen to. Now, Brubeck, I grew up with him when he had the trio and with Paul Desmond.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so fantastic. I think his music today transcends any age barrier. People can enjoy it just as much now as they could have 50 years ago. And I think that he was the first one that ever came up with a different type of mixing his time beats, such signatures, than anyone else. He was, like, very innovative.
No kidding.
And I just can't say enough good things about him. I still have a vinyl of his. I listen to it almost every weekend.
Charlie, enjoy it this weekend for the great Dave Brubeck. Ted, talk to us about, we had the listener saying, he was groundbreaking, experimental, without getting lost in freeform jazz. He wasn't bebop. There was a kind of split in the road, and not everybody was happy about it back in the day, Ted. Describe that for us.
Well, modern jazz came out in the 1940s. It brought the music to places it had never been. At the same time, the audience began to shrink, definitely in the 1950s and the 1960s as people moved on to other styles. What Dave did, and I really believe this is unique, I don't believe you can say this of another musician, he tried to push the music ahead in a very experimental, avant-garde way, and yet was enormously popular even with people that had no conception of jazz. And generally when we look at the history of art, there are the great experimental avant-garde people, and then mm-hmm. there are the popularizers, and they're very different. But what an extraordinary achievement to keep on pushing the music forward into these new terrains, doing different things, and then having million-selling hits. I really can't think of another example of someone who was able to do that.
Russell, what did he think of that? When people would say, well, this isn't Charlie Parker, this isn't bebop, it's too straight, this isn't what we want from, what about the people who wanted more freeform, Russell? What did Brubeck say?
Dave was always true to himself, and I think that is the key. When he spoke from his heart. When he played from his heart. All the discussion about 12-tone, mm-hmm. that's all true. The one caveat I have to put in is the fact that he didn't know he was writing in 12-tone. It would be pointed out to him later, said, Dave, that's did you right. realize that you just wrote the soprano solo in 12-tone? He said, no, I couldn't have done that. I said, look it, here it is, here's the row.
Where did that come from? Was it in, late 50s where he was touring around the world for the State Department. It was all over the place. Was it from
Mio told Dave, wherever you go, keep your ears open. And Dave wrote in Downbeat in the early 50s, and Ted, you've commented on this, which is he wrote this huge article about world music. We're talking about 1950, and Dave's already focusing on world music.
If you go back even earlier, there's an amazing story. I'm sure you've heard this, Russell, many times. But when Dave was still in the military, he got composition lessons from Arnold Schoenberg. Mm. And he got into an argument with Schoenberg. Schoenberg wanted to know why Dave played a certain note or a certain progression at a certain point. And Dave said, I did it because it sounded good.
Sounded good. That's right.
You know, and Schoenberg
which
thought
didn't
this
go
was,
over
that was an
really
unacceptable
well
reason.
With Arnold Schoenberg.
That's all right.
To me, that was like the essence of Dave's artistry is he went by the sound. And because of that, although we could sit here and talk about who influenced him, it's almost impossible to pick out those influences in his great recordings because he would go where his musical instinct and his ear took him rather than imitate. And that's actually true of very, very few jazz musicians or musicians in any genre.
Let's hear one
well,
here.
You figure on the trio. You know, the national anthem of bop was How High the Moon.
Yes.
And Dave recorded this with the trio, not as a bop, but he was using counterpoint and ended it with a Bach chorale ending.
Talk about taking your own way. Well, here's that one from, I think you conducted this, Russell, Gloyd. This is Pangalingua Variations, Bow Down. Dave Brubeck and the London Symphony Orchestra. Bobby, I believe you're in here too, Bobby Militello. This is 2003. Let's listen. My guest, Russell Gloyd, conducting there with the London Symphony Orchestra, and Bobby Militello right there on that beautiful, beautiful saxophone. Bobby, Dave Brubeck did not like the label Cool Jazz, I read here.
No.
Why? What was his objection?
I don't know specifically what his objection was, but Dave, of everything that's been said here, Dave is an ear player. That's basically what I said earlier. Mm-hmm. What you're listening to right now, that gorgeous melody, that beautiful ability for me to take a solo on something that literally right now I'm sitting here with my eyes closed, I can see the booth I'm in.
Yeah.
I can see myself back where I was, and I remember the feeling. I remember what I felt like. That's one of my better solos.
That's pretty
and
sweet.
And it's like Dave gave you vehicles that were melodic, honest, and they were from his soul. When he was on the stage, you never played the gig twice the same way.
Yeah.
That never happened. I mean, and I don't know if everyone believes this, but this is the truth. Every single day up until I think the last gig that we played was Montreal and in June. And wow. Up until the last gig that we played, every single night, take five was different. Every single night, every tune we played was different. He would count them at different tempos. He would give them a different groove. He might start an intro. And that free form was Dave's way of thinking. Whether he went into counterpoint, whether he went into polyphonic, which he did a lot, being chord on top of chord rather than playing in one key or playing in two keys.
Yeah.
He didn't know. That wasn't what he was thinking about. It was a conceptualization of what he heard in his head. It might have been something I played. It might have been something Mike Moore played or Randy Jones played. And he just took that and made a composite. And the beauty of what he did was that composite of what he heard. He would change everything about what he was doing, and we would all sit there and scratch our heads. What are you doing?
It's so beautiful. Russell, you're conducting there. I mean, he didn't like this tag cool, but it was cool. I mean, what was his objection there?
His comment would be, listen to Look for the Silver Lining and tell me that's
right.
Cool.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
This is a recording where Michael Brecker said, I only listened to it every day of my life for a year.
That's all.
Now, one thing about the symphony, you know, all of this is true, but the very first time I conducted the London Symphony, I came in 1,000% prepared. Every single note, every single page I knew. And we were doing this piece called Theme for June, which begins with a 16-measure piano introduction.
Yeah.
4 minutes into the 16-measure piano introduction, I've got two thoughts. Number one is he's forgotten what tune he's playing.
Yeah. Where are
and
we?
He's playing, you know, just to you know, have something latch in and then he can run with it. Or what's worse is he believes what he's playing is the 16-measure introduction. And, you know,
who knows,
he wonders what all the tension's about.
Right. Oh, we just want to hear more. This is Brubeck. This was 2007. And he was getting on, I think, 86 here. This is Thank You from the album Indian Summer. Him alone at his instrument and, you know, the clock of life ticking here. Thank you, Dave Brubeck. At 86 in 2007. Ted Gioia, you're listening. What do you hear there from the master?
He had been touring Europe for the State Department, had been giving many concerts in Poland, visited Chopin's home, and then on the train ride, the melody came to him, and this was his own Chopin-esque tribute. And it shows a different side of Dave. And once again, this is It sounds very different from his other recordings, but you could say that of many of his great works, almost each piece is reconceptualized based on what he's feeling and hearing then. A beautiful work, and it's very touching to think of the name that he gave it, Thank You. Originally he gave it the title in Polish, but it's also, I thinking of that as a good tribute piece because it's a way of us thanking Dave for what he's given us musically.
There's an interview just last year with the Digital Music Education Project at the Monterey Jazz Festival. And this is just last year, 90, 91, Dave Brubeck offering some advice to young musicians.
The main thing is to be able to concentrate on playing and the feeling of love for what you're doing is the most important thing. And survival in this music is hard to achieve, but if you hang in long enough, it usually comes around.
The feeling of love for what you're doing is the most important thing. Dave Brubeck's advice to young musicians there, Russell Cloyd. It sounds like it was never a question for him. That love of it is so evident.
Well, to follow up on Jean-Guy, which is thank you, his mother was a great classical pianist who had studied in London with Dame Myra Hess. And Dave's earliest memories of a child is being under the piano when he was 4 years old and hearing his mother play Chopin. Now the scene shifts to Dave's 85th birthday tour, which we did in 2005, and we were playing in Warsaw in the concert hall. And Dave introduces this piece and said the most incredible, moving statement I've ever heard from Dave, which is, "I wish my mother was here."
Wow. And you can hear his mother's legacy to him. You can hear the Chopin, and you can hear his thanks. Boy, we are feeling that thanks like crazy this week, and feeling it to all three of you. I'm so grateful to you for being with us just a couple of days after the passing of the great Dave Brubeck. We'll here, take five one more time on our way out. Bobby Militello, just such an honor and pleasure to have you with us from Buffalo today. Thank you so much, and our hearts with you. Keep on playing, Bobby, in tribute to Dave. But keep on playing.
I'll be playing later today.
We know you will. Russell Gloyd, with us from New Haven, Connecticut. Russell, thank you so much for everything all these years. You, Dave, Bobby, and everybody. But thank you, Russell, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Ted Gioia in Dallas, Texas. Thank you for joining us, Ted.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
And our heart goes out to all of the fans and lovers of Dave Brubeck's music and to his family in this week. For everybody who joined us today, our thanks and our salute to Dave Brubeck. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.